It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is the final day of Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we've been exploring different aspects of artistic Iowa. And today we're going to focus on emerging arts, alternative arts, maybe even stretch the definition of art a little bit. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a graffiti artist, a video game designer, a woman who makes prosthetic eyes, and comic book artist Phil Hester. And our guide through this today is Todd Behrens. He's curator of the Sioux City Art Museum. Hello, Todd.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And the question of what is art is a really big question, but give it a shot. What is your definition?
Oh, boy. In general, it is, to me, something, and it doesn't really matter what the material or the form, but it's something that captures a lot of what we all agree upon is important or beautiful, but what makes it art is something that takes it into that realm of someone's imagination, that when somebody else takes a look at it, they can see something that speaks to them, but they're seeing something that expands what's already in their level of experience and knowledge. That's a really bland way of saying it, but for me, it's something that holds to certain established standards for how something is made or composed, while taking it into that level that previously we couldn't possibly have imagined.
And is the audience an important part of art, or is it just the artist or the experience of creating the art that's the more important part?
I don't know if you could say which part is more important, but certainly the audience is the audience's response is absolutely vital, and that's been something that was part of the whole modernist movement, was understanding that back in the early 20th century that the viewer brings to the artwork his or her experiences, and that's what completes the artwork. The first conceptual artist, someone like Marcel Duchamp, he might do something that is absolutely outlandish, and essentially it's waiting for a response. Regardless of what that response is, it's that response that completes the artwork. And even people today who are working in more traditional forms, it's still a matter of what are people going to think that for them grounds what they're doing.
When I think about stories of great artists and how they emerged, there's a thread that comes up again and again, that when something new emerges, there's always this skepticism, this pushback in the art world. Do you think that is a fair assessment, that does seem to happen again and again?
Almost always. Critics, curators, people who are supposed to be the knowledgeable people in the art world are human, and there's it's hard to fight what we have set in our brains as this is what art is and this is what art is limited to. And so the best critics that you'll read are those that will acknowledge, you know what, I blew it. I saw that and I thought, nope, that was a gimmick. That was something that was just a one-off. But now I see how wrong I was. Now I see that was an important moment that has now transformed everything else. And so, yeah, it can be, we also can make mistakes on the other side in terms of thinking that this is something that's very important and then finding out, oh, nope, we blew that.
And you mentioned critics, critics in the art world often tell the rest of us what to think, but everybody's a critic. We all have our own personal reactions to things. Does it matter what the critics say?
To a point. I mean, what critics do at their best is act as a liaison from the artist to those of us who aren't looking directly at the artwork, and they can provide some kind of a context. That's what we try to do here at the Art Center and all the other institutions. You try to provide some information so that people can can get a better sense of the meaning behind the work, the importance of the work. But everybody has their own experiences. So going back to what I was just saying, you can have 10 people with the same amount of training and experience in the art world, throw them into a gallery filled with different artists, and they're all going to pick different things as what's best and what's worst. There's going to be a fair amount of uniformity because of the similarity in experiences, but there's still enough openness in art that something that I think isn't worth looking at is going to be a profound experience for somebody else, and often in the reverse. So we're all human, and critics and curators are just guides.
I'm talking with Todd Behrens, curator of the Sioux City Art Museum, and I want to bring a photographer into the conversation now. Mitch Nicholson is a photographer, and while no one would dispute, I don't think, that photography is an art form, he specializes in, quote, documenting the forgotten, the collapsed, and the condemned. You can follow him on Facebook at Abandoned Iowa. He's also on Tumblr. Hello, Mitch.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And I mean, making images, taking pictures is an art form, but you're taking pictures of things that a lot of people would consider to be ugly or things to be avoided. What attracted you to this subject matter?
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, a lot of people kind of have the assumption what I do is rather creepy or weird, but realistically, though, there's an aesthetic appeal with some of the locations I visit that you simply cannot find anywhere else. It's almost like stepping into a time capsule of the past in some of the locations I visit.
Are you trying to create beautiful images, or what is your goal when you capture an image?
My goal has kind of changed, actually. I've been doing the project for about 6 years now, and Abandoned Iowa has sort of evolved along the way. Initially, my intent was simply to document these places. I never considered myself an artist, nor did I feel like I had adequate equipment to take beautiful pictures. It wasn't until I got, you know, into the project a little further that I discovered other photographers doing similar work, and I realized I don't need great equipment to take beautiful pictures, and there is a lot of aesthetic appeal that reaches a large audience, as you can tell from my Facebook page, with some of these condemned places that I visit. It's very almost counterintuitive to be drawn to these places. It's like being drawn towards something dangerous. There is just a natural part, I think, of the human psyche that is aroused by the unknown. And I think that's kind of the appeal, ultimately, of my project. As the years kind of gone by and I started getting better at taking pictures and finding more locations, I did kind of refine my craft a little bit from just taking pictures for the sake of documentation to taking pictures for the sake of presenting something in a framed kind of way towards my audience on Facebook.
So guiding your audience more than just showing them something.
Exactly.
Now, when you take these images, you're, of course, framing the picture and composing the picture. But also, I think about the fact that the things that you're taking pictures of have been shaped by time, by economic conditions,
yes.
By weather. Do you think about how those other elements are also creating your image?
Oh, absolutely. Whenever you... I do get the opportunity to step into an abandoned location. The signs are there. There's molds. There's weather damage. The ceilings collapse. The air is cooler. It smells different than the outside. It's really an entirely different atmosphere than what you just walked out of usually. That being said, it's hard to explain to people exactly what the appeal is, but when you show these pictures, it does elicit a response. In fact, on my page, I get a lot of people reminiscing about some of the locations I've been to. They have memories from childhood of being there,
So sometimes you're eliciting responses you didn't expect, huh?
Exactly. In fact, that's one of the biggest surprises I've had since starting this was the responses I've gotten from people. It's not just people saying, oh, these places are interesting, I like your pictures. It's, wow, I used to go there. Or, wow, I used to drive over this bridge every day going to my grandmother's house, something like that. So you do establish a connection. And that just kind of happened inadvertently, but I think that's really contributed to the success of our project.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're very welcome.
Mitch Nicholson is the man behind Abandoned Iowa. You can see his images on Facebook. You can also follow him on Tumblr as well. And Todd Behrens is still with me, curator of the Sioux City Art Museum. And listening to Mitch, Todd, obviously he has honed his craft as a photographer. But in this day and age, everybody has a camera in their pocket. And people are taking pictures all the time. That puts, and other kinds of technology also put art within the grasp of so many people. If you take pictures that you love, if you're making images that you love with your cell phone camera, do you think that makes somebody an artist in some way?
Often it depends on intent. I have my phone literally overloaded with images. Very few of them, I would say, have any kind of real creativity to them. I'm just kind of snapping along as I go. And they all have a very special meaning to me, which is why I can't seem to delete them. But it's a really fun project, thinking about what's going on right now. I almost think that the value of all the photography that's being done is almost it's more valuable as a complete project itself, where everybody who has a phone, everybody from preschoolers up to the elderly, taking shots with abandon. And it would be fun to pull together absolutely everything that's being done and have it speak to our time, because it is this moment in which technology has made all of this this potential available to
us. It's almost like a giant art project.
A giant art project.
Todd Behrens, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Todd Behrens is curator of the Sioux City Art Museum. This hour, we're asking the question, what is art? And talking with artists who really defy our expectations. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this week, we've been talking about different aspects of artistic Iowa as we celebrate Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. And this hour, we're exploring the question, what is art? We'll also talk about where some alternative art forms fit into the art world. And my next guest is part of one of those alternative art worlds. He goes by the name As Fate Would Have It. He's a graffiti artist who lives in Des Moines. Hello.
How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And take us back in time a little bit. When did you first get into graffiti art?
I got into graffiti writing about 10 years ago. And I would say my first 4 years of participating in the craft were all done at nighttime. If that gives you any idea of how I got into things. Freight train writing and clandestine mural writing was kind of my thing at first. I've since then evolved into getting into full-scale murals, sanctioned and commissioned murals, so that's kind of where I'm at now.
And you say graffiti writing. For those of us not in the world of graffiti writing, what exactly does that mean? It doesn't mean that it's just words, right?
It does not mean that, but the reason that we tend to lean towards using the term writing is because it is rooted in word form. It is rooted in letter form. And so what we mean by that is we have an understanding of letter form, letter anatomy. We create our own alphabets. Most graffiti writers come up with a name for themselves, and that name becomes an identity that represents them. And so that combination of letters that they come up with, it becomes something that they cherish. They want to be better at creating that combination of letters than anyone else. They want to be more creative in coming up with various fonts to fill out those letters than anyone else. And so we use the term writing because it all begins with understanding letter anatomy and letter form. Now, a graffiti writer does eventually evolve into other aspects of painting with a spray can, whether it be characters and imagery and background and things of that sort. But in our world, it is a must that you have an understanding of letter form and letter anatomy, and that if you create a name that's 5 or 6 letters, or in my case, 7 letters, that all of those letters, when they're on a wall, appear to have come from the same alphabet.
Well, and you mentioned that your early work was largely done at night and not sanctioned, and
right.
That, I'm sure that played an important role in what drew you to doing this kind of art, that kind of rush and excitement. But as you have evolved and have gotten involved in sanctioned projects, commissioned murals, how does that change the art form for you? It takes away that element.
It certainly does. And, you know, I've had to, I feel like I've had to go through a stage of maturity and development, because the culture of graffiti writers are somewhat split on the issue of, do we still consider it the same thing, and do we still consider it writing when there's permission and you have all day and you can take time to reevaluate and revise something? Is it different than what the original artwork was intended to be? In fact, as soon as I'm done here with this interview, I'll be leaving to go conduct a course, a workshop, an 8-week workshop that I hold in the spring and the fall with the Des Moines Public School System, and it's all about this thing. There was a point where when it was brought up to me and offered to me, I declined such things, and the reason I declined them was because it made no sense to me whatsoever that little Bobby's mom could go sign him up to be in a graffiti writing class, and little Bobby may or may not want to participate in the class, but because mom has signed him up, he's going to be in there, and I'm going to have to teach him. And I didn't agree with that, because in my mind, you know, based on how I came up and how I was introduced to the craft, that's not how you do it. You have to show an extra initiative. You have to show the want to go out and do things longer than someone else has to do, harder than someone else has to do. You have to be willing to trudge through a mile or two in the woods down some train tracks to finally get to your canvas and hope that the canvas doesn't pull off on you in the middle of painting it. You know, you come back the next day to maybe get a picture of your train, and unfortunately, it's gone. That transient nature of the art is certainly lost when you get into the commissioned realm and the sanctioned realm. But I would say that I've since evolved to a point where I think we're doing a disservice to the younger generations if we expect them to go through all of the toil and obstacles that perhaps we had to help legitimize this art and participate in it. And so now I'm at a point where I'd rather just share the positive aspects of it. But I had to evolve to that. I certainly had to evolve to that. But you make a good point in terms of, does that change the art for us? It does sometimes. I've gotten bored doing mural work before because the intrigue of perhaps having to run away while I hear a twig snap over my shoulder is now gone, you know? But I value it, and I do appreciate it in this day and age.
Now, you still work with a name that you created for yourself, and I introduced you by that name, as fate would have it. And I'm sure there are some people who think, okay, he's going under a pseudonym, and graffiti's just vandalism anyway. So what is the importance for maintaining that name, that version of yourself that you've invented that represents the part of you that is this graffiti writer?
The significance of the name came into play because there were kids from all, you know, nationalities and backgrounds and walks of life and socioeconomic backgrounds, black, white, Cambodian, any race you can think of, who they may not have been the most popular kid. They may be the kid that gets picked on. They may be the most unassuming kid in the world when you look at them. But behind closed doors and at nighttime, when they put a can to the wall, they're creating the most beautiful thing. Those names, the graffiti names that those kids have chosen for themselves and developed in terms of the illustrative work and put up in so many places, those names have a legendary status that physical kid actually doesn't have. That kid may still be getting picked on in person by his peers and by the people at school, but when people see that name writing on walls and other graffiti writers see that name, they have a high respect for it because of the level of prowess that they can ascertain in looking at his work or her work. So all importance comes to the name, because that identity for some begins to be an identity that fulfills some aspects of life that a lot of times their normal, regular, physical person didn't fulfill. My name, As Fate, you know, the significance behind it, the last part would have it, is actually more of a joke. I used to not like talking to media very much, and so I would just tell them my name is As Fate, and when they fell for that, thinking that that was my actual government first name, they'd say, well, what's your last name? And so I just eventually came up with, it's Would Have It. You know, like As Fate Would Have It. But As Fate is generally what I go by. While it began as a joke, I almost came to develop a meaning for it, which is, you know, I come as I am, and I leave as I am, and you have to take me for what I am. As fate would have it, this is who I am, and this is what I have to present to you. You either accept it or you don't. So that's perhaps the loose meaning behind the name, but I think a greater point is, what is the significance of a name for a writer in general? And the answer to that would be, it can be an identity that for that person, that male or female, achieves a level of status that perhaps they didn't think they were capable of, they didn't have the competence to pursue. I think that's the bigger thing here.
As Fate, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
As Fate Would Have It, a graffiti artist based in Des Moines. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This hour we're talking about alternative arts, or arts and artists that just don't really fit the mold that we all have in mind when we think about art. And next up, Americans spend more than $5.2 billion on video games every year. So we know that it's big business. But are video game designers artists? Or maybe is there a kind of artistic experience that comes about when you play a game? With me now are two men with some strong opinions on that. Ryan Holtkamp is a video game producer. Right now he's working on producing a game called The 13th Doll. It's a horror game. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And Jason Burns is also with us. He is an avid gamer, both video games and board games. He's also one of my colleagues. He's IPR's broadcast operations manager. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
And I know that you do have some really strong opinions about video games in particular as art. So make your case for me.
I like the definition of art when it is as basic as it possibly can be. Because I thought about this a lot before coming on the show. And I think the best way to describe art, just generally, is something that's human-made and something which, when experienced, causes you to think and feel. Because I think the best art, regardless of whatever medium we're talking about, can be framed in those terms. You know, are all photographs art? No. But are good photographs that are artistic, do they convey a message that makes you think and feel? Yes. Are all films art? A lot of people have some criticisms against, you know, Michael Bay, for instance, and maybe the artistic merits of some of the big summer boom, you know, films. So maybe not all of those are art, but there are a lot of films that are certainly artistic. So I think when you frame it in that lens, I think it becomes a lot easier to talk about video games as art, because as a lifelong gamer, I have had multiple situations where I've been sitting in front of a TV with a controller in my hand, either laughing or openly weeping, or, you know, some combination of A and B.
All right, so give me an example.
So a recent game that I played, which really took me through kind of an emotional roller coaster, was called Firewatch. And the premise of the game is you are at the Shoshone National Forest, and you have taken a summer job, literally as a lookout, as someone who's basic responsibility is to just make sure if there's a fire, it's phoned in. And what I love about this game is that it really uses the medium of games and interactiveness to tell a story, but also involve you in the story in a way that I think video games uniquely can. I think if this story were a film, it would still be a really interesting film, but I think it would be less impactful, because the game starts by involving you in the biography of the character. It's a short story in words, but it's almost like a choose-your-own-adventure novel, because at periods you're deciding whether you and your girlfriend are going to get a small dog or a big dog or no pets, or if you're going to move for her job or if she's going to move for your job. And the long story short is you kind of get this biography of this character, his relationship to his wife, and then his wife experiences sudden-onset dementia. And it goes through basically what brought you to this job to get away from it all. And the thing that's so elegant about this game is that the story is basically told entirely between you and another character named Delilah, who's another lookout in basically 5 miles away. You can see her tower, but you can never actually see her. And the characters are so real, they're so well portrayed, that you really develop relationships in this to this character. You really kind of begin to feel camaraderie. And I've got a little clip here of an interaction with the main character of the game, Henry, and Delilah, that really just kind of frames, you know, their relationship.
Delilah's a nice name.
No, you big dummy.
I was kidding.
No, you were not. You're sweet, but we can't call it the Delilah Fire.
Okay, what then?
How about my middle name, June?
The June Fire, even though it's July.
I like it.
So in that clip, they're naming a fire that breaks out in the middle of the forest, and that's literally an option that you can pick. You can call it something silly like the Big Fire, or you can call it something kind of serious, or you can choose that option, which gives you that unique bit of dialogue where, you know, you sort of endear yourself to Delilah. And because the medium is interactive, I feel like it does this great job of pulling you in and investing you in the story in a way that only games can. And it really, you know, I developed a lot of, you know, feelings about Henry and his situation and how he reacted to Delilah. And I thought about that game a lot after
so
I finished it.
It sounds like almost a combination between an experience that you would have reading a book or participating in a play or as something that really pulls you in and helps you empathize with a character and you become part of this artistic experience.
Absolutely. And I think that is that's why it's a very exciting time to be a video game fan, because game developers are really playing with all of these elements. You know, I wouldn't have expected a game about wandering around in the woods to be as emotionally involving as it was. I mean, some people actually refer to these games as walking simulators, which is kind of a derisive term because really you're literally, there's not a lot of gameplay to it. You're not, you know, you don't have a lot of skills to master or anything like that, but you're literally guiding the character from point A to B.
Well, and I want to bring Ryan into the conversation. As a video game producer, I mean, Ryan, you're creating images, but you're also creating this story. How do you think about what you're doing?
Well, I think as bringing back the art thing, I think what we're doing, well, as when you experience art, you experience a painting on the wall or you experience, you know, a symphony or something like that. It's a very visceral experience, but video games have that element where it is a personal experience. And I think Jason's description of what art is, making you feel emotion, making you think, is really what I'm trying to do and really what a lot of other game designers are trying to do. And I think that's a very new thing in the genre of video games. You know, I think there's been a longstanding argument whether video games are art, and I think right now is an interesting time because people are really experimenting with things, and a lot of people are doing it out of passion, more out of commerce. You know, not trying to make a profit, but trying to create an experience. And it was earlier when Todd mentioned Duchamp, that was pretty poignant because here's a guy who took a urinal, put it in an art gallery, and said, "Hey, this is art." Well, why is it art? Because I say it's art, and so. I think video games are kind of taking that sort of thing where they really challenge you and they really challenge the definition. And I think it's kind of a thing that's evolving. And, you know, me as a game designer, our game is it's a horror game. It's set in a haunted mansion. It's the story of two characters who one is an asylum inmate and the other is his doctor. And throughout the game, you have to decide whether to trust each other and who to trust and what that rival, and there's a rivalry that develops. And as the story continues, I really want the player to feel some emotion. There's some really tough choices you have to make towards the end of the game. And those choices, you're going to have to kill someone and you have to pick who. That's not an experience that you can get from any other medium that I'm familiar with. I mean, you can watch a film, but that film isn't something where you're personally making a choice like that.
And you're bringing together a bunch of different elements as you're writing the script, which could have multiple endings, but also the visual design as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a number of different things that have to come together to make a video game. you know, there's sound, there's the aesthetics, there's the graphics, there's the dialogue in the story, not just the plot itself, but the dialogue has to be compelling. We'd had a plot written for a long time, and then when it comes time to write the dialogue, it was really frustrating to get, you know, gets concise dialogue that told the story, conveyed the message we want, and gave the feeling and the emotion, and kind of, you know, gave reference to different themes that we were trying to you know, give the player. So there's a lot of things going on all at the same time. They all have together, and they have to be fun and compelling at the same time. So it's a real challenge.
Ryan Holtkamp, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ryan Holtkamp is a video game producer. He's working on producing a game called The 13th Doll, which is a horror game. And Jason Burns, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Charity.
Jason Burns is an avid gamer, video games and board games. He's also Iowa Public Radio's broadcast operations manager. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're wrapping up Iowa Week and our week-long exploration of artistic Iowa today with a conversation about art and artists who defy our expectations of what art is. And my next guest knew that she wanted to be a very specific kind of artist from a pretty young age. She is an ocularist. That means she makes prosthetic eyes, and the eyes she makes are definitely works of art. Vaughn Bulgarelli does her work at Iowa Eye Prosthetics in Coralville. Vaughn, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And you knew you wanted to do this since you were about in third grade?
Third grade, yes.
All right, and I know that this was a family business. Tell me how you got involved.
So my father has been doing it since 1968. I grew up around it. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. I enjoy being creative. I enjoy building and making things, and this allows me to combine my creativeness and my artisticness together and do something for people.
Let's talk about the creative part of this process. I guess let's talk about this process first. When you make a prosthetic eye for someone, how do you do it?
So we begin after the patient has had their eye removed. We begin by taking an impression of their eye socket and then making a wax model of that shape. And with the wax model, we actually shape the lids and the opening to be as symmetrical as we can to their own living eye. And then the same prominence level and direction of gaze. And once we get that part done, we make a mold around the wax model and we duplicate it in plastic. And it's in the plastic part that we actually do the painting and veining, and we use embroidery thread to vein the eye so it creates a lifelike structure of veins. And then we use a powder pigment mixed with a liquid plastic, and that makes an acrylic paint. And we just put layers and layers of the different pigments to create the lifelike color and natural look of the eye. It's through the brush strokes and the layering techniques that we do that actually create the depth and lifelikeness of their eye in the artificial eye. And by the time we get done, there's about 200 plus layers of thin layers of paint.
Wow. And of course, eye color, it's something we all know immediately about ourselves. I have brown eyes, I have blue eyes, I have green eyes. But when you actually look at someone's eyes, there are so many different colors and different kinds of eyes. How do you match your pigment to this living eye?
So we use daylight reproducing bulbs in our office so that everything is natural daylight. And you look very closely within 2 to 3 inches of the person's face at their eye. And you can see that, yes, if they have a brown eye, you can see all these flecks of oranges and reds and things that make up that color. And the same thing with blue eyes. Most people with blue eyes have a lot of texture and design, and it's almost like a kaleidoscope kind of look when you actually look into their iris. And then you make note of where the positions of the different designs are in the eye, and you duplicate that on the artificial eye to make it look exactly like their own. What is amazing to me is going from a black disc, basically, you know, no color, to 200 to 300 layers of paint later, and you're amazed that it looks as real as it does. And I've been doing it for 28 years, and I still am surprised at how well they look and turn out.
I think about my kids and, of course, what their eyes looked like when they were babies and how they've changed. The color has changed. Obviously, the size has changed. When you work with kids, how often do you update a prosthetic eye?
Pretty frequently. I had one little girl that I was making a new eye almost every 4 months. Most is every year to 2 years. And, you know, when they're an adult, it's every 5, 7, something like that, years. But yes, the kids grow and change. And when you are real young, the color of your eye starts out lighter, it gets darker. And then as you get older, it gets lighter. And as you get older, the white of your eye gets darker. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of changes. And just like your clothes change on how they fit, so does the eye, because your socket changes with age, growth, weight gain, loss, pregnancy, all those kinds of things can make a change.
With adults, if you're updating the eye, is it because the prosthetic eye has worn out, or is it because their body has changed?
It can be both. The plastic does have a shelf life type thing, but usually it's a structural thing inside of them that has changed.
You brought a box of prosthetic eyes.
I did.
With you today, and looking in that box, there are a couple things that I noticed. One is that on a couple of the eyes that look very realistic, along the edge of the eye, the white of the eye, part that would be in the head
mm-hmm.
or under the eyelid, I see on one there's a fish, on one there's the word up.
And an arrow.
And an arrow. So mm-hmm. what's that about?
So I like to put tattoos on the eyes, if you want to call them that. And it just kind of makes it a little more personal for the person. It makes it less scary. For kids, they think it's pretty cool. I had one guy that I painted an American flag on it, and he went to a gas station, and the person behind the counter had a tattoo on their arm. And my patient said, "Wow, bet that tattoo hurt, but probably not as bad as mine." And the person behind the counter was like, "What are you talking about?" And he lifted up his upper lid and he looked down and you could see the American flag up there. And he said, "It hurt like a son of a gun. I'll never get that done again." And then he left. So the woman or the man, whoever was behind the counter, had no idea that it was an artificial eye.
There's also an eye in the box that looks like an 8-ball from pool.
Yes.
What that doesn't look particularly natural. What's that about?
So we have some patients that like to have a little fun, and this also lets me be very creative. And this particular individual wanted an eye that looked like an 8-ball because he likes to play pool. I've done different ones from school logos to sport logos to whatever it is, you know, a patient would want. In this particular case, the white back behind the 8 actually glows in the dark. And so... you know, you hold a flashlight up to it, and then you go out. It's pretty cool.
Are these ideas that your patients have brought to you, or do you work with them to come up with the perfect idea?
So I spend 2 days making an eye with each patient, and you can kind of get a feel if they want to have fun with it, if they don't want to have fun with it. And if they do want to, I propose, you know, a fun one can be made along with one that looks like their normal eye. And just by talking to them and finding out their likes, dislikes, you know, we come up with different ideas, and a lot of times they'll come up with their own. I have one individual, he has 5 different ones, and I have a high school student who has 4 different ones.
What are his like?
The high school student has a soccer ball, a basketball, a school logo, and a football with glow-in-the-dark laces. And his school logo glows in the dark also.
So he can change his eye depending on what sport
Absolutely.
He's participating in.
Yes. It began originally because his mom didn't want him to lose an expensive eye on the soccer field. So we made one that was less expensive, that looked like a soccer ball, and that's what he wore.
A fun eye.
Right. And then he moved on to the next sport, and then the next sport.
You are working in a medical field. You are helping patients, in some cases, I'm sure, changing lives. Do you consider yourself to be a care provider or an artist?
Yes. One of the biggest joys of my job is having a person come in who feels incomplete, and then when I get done, that they feel complete. Last week, I had a little boy. He was 8 years old, and he looked in the mirror, and this says it all. He looked in the mirror, and he said, "It looks just like my other eye." And he was ecstatic.
Vaughn, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Vaughn Bulgarelli is an ocularist at Iowa Eye Prosthetics in Coralville. This hour, we're talking about alternative kinds of art. And Phil Hester is here with us now. He's a comic book artist and writer who lives in North English, and he's worked on many, many comic books, Wonder Woman, Superman Confidential, The Irredeemable Ant-Man, many other books. He's got a new book, Shipwreck, with science fiction writer Warren Ellis, coming out October 5th, and he's also going to be at Midwest Comic Con in Des Moines on November 5th. Phil, thanks for coming back to the show.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
And I think that comic book art is something that's gotten a lot more respect in recent years. But let's go back in time to when you started doing this. How do you think people thought about comic book art then?
I don't think they did. I think we were like this sort of orphan, illegitimate art form. And to be honest, I still sort of treasure that status. I mean, it's a sort of a freedom we have that we don't have to. Listen, I have a BFA. I sat in on a million different critiques and a million late night discussions about what is art, you know, and gone around and around that hamster wheel. And in a way, it was more fun, more liberating. It let me express myself more freely to not think about that stuff, to just go do my thing. And comics are sort of, you know, we're like the way rock and roll was in the 50s or 60s or hip hop in the 80s. We're so outside of the mainstream that nobody cares what we're doing. And that's liberating. And it's a fun place to be. And I kind of cling to that still, even though my own taste, I really like the more high-minded artsy comics as well as the superhero comics. I still like that sort of outsider status we have.
Did you, when you first started doing this, did you think about yourself as an artist? I mean, you were getting a bachelor's mm-hmm. of fine arts, but did you think what you were doing was creating art?
Yeah, I never separated those two things in my mind. Although I had this weird idea in that my career would be too like bifurcated. I'd have this cartooning career and I'd also have a fine art career. And there wasn't too much crossover. And then I don't know about in the early 90s, a lot of just comics themselves were a lot more accepting of work that was outside the mainstream or what was traditional cartooning. And I thought, well, I can try to marry those two like impulses I have and express myself just how I want, you know, in both places.
So before you thought you could bring both of those sides together, I mean, did you feel like you were creating something that was lesser when you were doing the comic book art?
I thought I was creating something more fun, you know. And
it was too fun to be art?
Yeah, it was too fun to be legit. I don't know. Like I said, people wrestle with that idea about what is art all the time. And I think the beautiful thing about art, especially the kind of art you're talking about today, is people just make it. Whether it's sanctioned or not, whether it's premeditated or not. It's like language. It's just something we do, and it's how we express ourselves, and there's no way to contain it, and to me, that's wonderful.
We were talking earlier in the hour about the interaction between the artist and the audience, and that's got to be kind of a unique interaction for comic book artists. What is it like?
We meet the consumers of our art face-to-face a lot at comic book conventions. And on message boards and on social media. So you have a lot of, and they're not shy about telling you, you know, if like you messed up Captain America, you'll hear about it. So it's, you know, you often hear when you do wrong, but you also hear a lot of praise, and it's rare because I don't think fine arts people get to experience that as much, you know, maybe at gallery showings or at symposiums, but comic book people, I go on, you know, if I go on Twitter today, you know, I may hear one person complain about the way I draw the Hulk, but I'll have 20 people, you know, talking up, you know, my next new project. And that's a nice balance.
When you are creating your drawings, do you think about your fans? Do you think about the audience?
No, I try. Well, I'm still a fan myself. I'm an avid comic book reader and actually an original art collector. I collect the original art of other artists. So I still just come from my own perspective as what do I want to see? What do I want to express? Because there are so many voices in comics now and so many new voices that grew up in different traditions than what I grew up in. that they're all covering their own bases, and I don't have to reach out and try to cover the same things. I just need to do what's important to me to express myself.
Are you ever surprised by what your fans get out of what you do? I mean, I think artists, when they create something, they have an idea often of what kind of reaction mm-hmm. they are expecting, but I'm sure that doesn't always line up with reality.
No, but that's the fun part of it to me. Like, sometimes you'll create something and you think, oh, this is a character that's a one-off and no one's going to care about this character later. And it turns out it's somebody's favorite character ever. Or it speaks to their life circumstances. One of the best examples of that for me was we created a character called Speedy in Green Arrow. And we thought, well, she's a guest star here and there. And I went to a San Diego Comic-Con and I got out of the cab. And I'm not joking. The very first person I saw on the sidewalk outside of the convention was a young lady dressed up as Speedy in the costume that I designed. Now, I couldn't say anything to her because that is beyond creepy to, like, jump out of a cab and say, I created you, you know, to a young woman, you know. So I didn't say anything to her, but that was like a touchstone moment in my career. And
because you clearly really moved her.
Yeah, and that character was, like, the first HIV-positive character in comics ever. So it moved a lot of people that were dealing with that issue, too. So, you know, every artist is in that situation. Once you're done with it and it's out of your hands, you can't control the reactions to it, good or bad.
You talked about trying to kind of cling to your underdog status. Yeah. Does the popularity of comic books, does the legitimacy that has been achieved, does that take anything away from it for you?
No, I think we still always find little safe havens, little, you know, rabbit holes that we can go down and explore. No matter how many cartoonists win MacArthur grants or how many, you know, books get nominated for Pulitzer Prizes or whatever, there's still the underground aspect of comics that I think will probably never go away. And that's what's great about it.
And with so many different artists involved, do you see the art form evolving as a whole, or is it a lot of separate pieces?
It's a lot of separate pieces, but they're all moving forward. It's really exciting. There's so few barriers between you and a mass market in comics that it's one of the, you know, like, there are 100 people that want to give you notes about your screenplay. And even in mainstream comics, there's only you, your editor, and a publisher. And with the web and with small press comics, there's nothing between you and your audience. So you just go out there and make it.
Phil Hester, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
Comic book artist Phil Hester, his new book, Shipwreck, is being released on October 5th. He is working on that along with sci-fi writer Warren Ellis. He'll also be at Midwest Comic Con in Des Moines on November 5th. It's been Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa. Thank you for being with us this week. Of course, we'll be back next Friday with Horticulture Day, but I hope you enjoyed this journey through artistic Iowa. I sure did. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.